Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history program, The Making of a Nation. But first, the Islamic State militant group has claimed responsibility for two suicide bombings in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. The Associated Press reports that the suicide bombers killed at least 25 people, including 9 Afghan journalists. At least 45 other people were reported wounded. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, said 3 of its journalists were among those killed. The Afghan Journalist Safety Committee, a local group, strongly condemned the bombings. They are being described as the deadliest attacks ever on media workers in Afghanistan. Afghan officials and witnesses said the first bomb exploded in central Kabul during the early morning hours when many people were going to work. They said a bomber riding a motorbike caused the explosion near an office of the National Directorate of Security, the country's intelligence agency. When rescue workers and media crews gathered in the area minutes later, a second attacker who looked like a journalist caused his bomb to explode. A Kabul police official told VOA that the second explosion caused most of the casualties. "We condemn in the strongest terms possible the cowardly attacks in Kabul by two suicide bombers that killed and injured Afghan forces and innocent Afghan citizens," said American General John Nicholson. He commands United States forces and NATO's non-combatant operations in the country. Hours after the attack in Kabul, unknown gunmen killed an Afghan journalist working for the British Broadcasting Corporation in the border city of Khost. A short time later, the Afghan Taliban released a statement. The group denied involvement in the attacks in both cities. Worsening security conditions across Afghanistan have added to the difficulties facing journalists. At least 15 journalists were killed there in 2017, many in targeted attacks on the media. In a report last week, the group Reporters Without Borders accused the Taliban and Islamic State militants of using terror to create what it called information black holes. In some parts of Afghanistan, it said, the Taliban forced the media to pay taxes that were likened to payments made to free kidnap victims from captivity. The report said, many governors and local officials are meanwhile unable to accept the principle of media independence, and the police and military have been implicated in several cases of violence against journalists.
The number of Irrawaddy dolphins in one part of the Mekong River has increased for the first time in 20 years. The dolphins, however, still face serious threats to their survival. They are considered critically endangered marine mammals in their native Southeast Asia. The Cambodian government and a major wildlife group reported the population increase earlier this week. Cambodia's Fisheries Administration and the World Wildlife Fund released results of a 2017 count of freshwater dolphins along a 190-kilometer part of the Mekong. The survey area stretches from Kra Tie in Cambodia to the Khon Falls in Laos. Observers reported finding about 90 dolphins. That is a 15% increase over an estimate of 80 made in 2015. The dolphins are found in only two other freshwater rivers, the Irrawaddy River in Myanmar and the Mahakam River on the Indonesian part of Borneo Island. Ung Chee San is the Director General of Cambodia's Fisheries Administration. He described the dolphins as a living national treasure. He added that efforts to save the rare animals will continue. "We will continue our conservation efforts to rebuild its population by eliminating all threats to the survival of the species," he said. Although the increase during the latest count is good news, the number reported in the Mekong is only half of the 200 found during the first population count in 1997. Surveys are carried out every 2 to 3 years. Seng Teek is the WWF director for Cambodia. He told reporters in Phnom Penh that the dolphins still face threats from illegal fishing methods, increasing boat traffic, and new dam projects. He said the biggest threat for the marine mammals is to get caught in gill nets, large traps which are held in place through the use of floats and weights. Seng Teek said several thousand meters of illegal fishing nets had been seized and many fishermen arrested. The most recent survey showed hopeful signs for the long-term survival of the dolphins. More baby dolphins, called calves, have been reported and deaths are down. The study found that 32 dolphins have been born in the area during the past 3 years. Seng Teek said efforts by the WWF, the government, the tourism industries, and local communities have made a difference. "After years of hard work, we finally have reason to believe that these iconic dolphins can be protected against extinction," he said. The WWF says the dolphin is an important sign of the health of the Mekong River environment. "Dolphin watching and ecotourism is an important business for communities on the river. Some people living in Cambodia and Laos consider the animals holy." I'm Mario Ritter.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Nearly 2.4 billion people around the world used a smartphone in 2017. By the end of 2018, more than a third of the global population will be using a smartphone. These numbers from Mobile Marketing Magazine sound great, don't they? More people will have more information at their fingertips. However, smartphone technology can be a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it sends us unlimited amounts of information. We don't have to wait. Our devices ring, ping, vibrate, and light up with the latest news from family, friends, and around the world. On the other hand, this immediate access to information may become an addiction, and it may make some people feel lonely, anxious, and depressed. These findings are from a 2018 study from San Francisco State University and have been published in Neuroregulation. Eric Pepper and Richard Harvey are both health education professors at the university. They led the study. In a statement to the press, the two professors claim that overuse of smartphones is just like any other type of substance abuse. Pepper explains that smartphone addiction forms connections in the brain that are similar to drug addiction. And these connections form slowly over time. Also, addiction to social media may affect our emotional state. The two professors asked 135 university students about their smartphone use and their feelings. They found that students who used their phones the most reported higher levels of feeling lonely, depressed, and anxious. Pepper and Harvey do not blame users for their technology addiction. They blame the tech industry's desire to increase corporate profits. As Pepper writes, more eyeballs, more clicks, more money. The researchers warn that workers in the technology industry know how to manipulate our brains and turn us into addicts. But the researchers also suggest ways to fight back. They say that we can train our brains to be less addicted to our phones and computers. Eric Pepper suggests turning off push notifications and other such alerts on our phones. These instant announcements excite the same pathways in our brains that once warned us of dangers in our environment. But instead of warning us of a large predator looking for dinner, we are alerted to a sale on shoes, or the fact that a friend from high school is eating a hamburger in Las Vegas. More often than not, our devices share unimportant information, as if our lives depended on it. Our brains see the notices the same way, and that is a problem. So just turn them off. The researchers also suggest taking control of when and where you answer a text or email. You do not need to answer them all, and you certainly don't need to answer them as soon as you get them. They also suggest setting limits on the time you spend on social media. If you want to catch up with friends on Facebook, set aside a small amount of time to do it. Schedule periods of the day to focus on important tasks and do not allow technology to interfere. Two of Eric Pepper's students share ways they have changed their use of technology. One student, Kari McKendall, closed his social media accounts. He says he still calls and texts people, but he adds that he wants to spend most of his time with his friends in person, not online. Another student, Sierra Hinkle,
says she has stopped wearing headphones while she is out. She says this makes her more aware of her surroundings. And when she is with her friends at a bar or restaurant, they all put their phones in the center of the table. The first one to touch a phone buys everyone a drink. Hinkle says that she and her friends aim to use technology in ways that are useful, but that don't take away from real-life experiences. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The 1880s were years of important change in American business and industry. 20 years after the Civil War, the United States had become one of the leading industrial nations of the world. As the number of factories increased, so did competition between businesses. Some industrialists cooperated with their competitors to reduce competition. But this did not always succeed. There was no legal way to enforce their agreements. Leo Scully and Jack Weitzel tell how these issues were handled during the administration of President Benjamin Harrison.
In 1879, a new form of business organization was developed, the trust. In a trust, stock owners of many competing companies give control of their stock to a committee or group of trustees. The trustees operate all the companies as one and pay profits to the stockholders. The profits would be high because there would be no competition to drive down prices. One of the first trusts was formed by John D. Rockefeller in the oil industry. The stockholders of 77 oil companies gave control of their stock to 9 trustees of Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company. The 9 men controlled 90% of the nation's oil production.
The success of the Standard Oil Company led to the creation of trusts in other industries. Soon, there was a sugar trust, a salt trust, a steel trust, even a whiskey trust. These huge corporations represented hundreds of millions of dollars. This great wealth made them very powerful. Former President Cleveland, himself a friend of business, warned of a growing danger. Corporations, he said, should be carefully controlled creatures of the law and servants of the people. Instead, they are fast becoming the people's masters.
The public began to demand government controls of the trusts. Farmers claimed that prices were too high, and they blamed the trusts. Workers said their unions could not negotiate with the new industrial giants. Small businessmen charged that trusts were too powerful. They said the trusts could destroy them. Public demands for action led the governments of 15 states to pass antitrust laws. But the state laws could do nothing. Most of the trusts were nationwide corporations, which did business in many states. Public protest was so great that both parties in the 1888 elections promised to pass a federal law against trusts.
A number of such bills were proposed. One, offered by Senator John Sherman, a Republican, was approved by Congress. President Benjamin Harrison signed it into law in 1890. The Sherman antitrust law sounded severe. It said it was illegal for a trust or any other organization to interfere with interstate commerce, trade among the states. It was also illegal for any person or organization to form a monopoly, to get control of a whole industry. The law ordered harsh punishment for any person found guilty of these crimes. It sounded like a strong law, but it was not. It was written in a very general way that left the courts to decide what the law really said. Opponents of the Sherman antitrust bill said its purpose was not to destroy trusts, but to make the public believe that trusts would be destroyed.
During President Harrison's administration, only 8 corporations were accused of violating the new antitrust law. Of the 8, only 1 was found guilty, and only in a very limited way. The first company charged was the Whiskey Trust. A court dismissed the case. It said the government failed to prove that the trust had interfered with interstate commerce. A few years later, the government asked the courts to break up the huge sugar trust, which controlled 98% of the sugar-producing industry. The Supreme Court refused to do so. It said that it was true the trust had formed a monopoly in the sugar-producing industry, but it said the monopoly was in manufacturing, not in trade or interstate commerce. Therefore, said the High Court, the sugar trust was legal and did not violate the antitrust law.
Industrial trusts helped to reduce competition among American companies. High tariffs also gave some protection from competition with foreign companies. But business leaders were not satisfied. They demanded even higher taxes on imports to further reduce competition. So Republican Congressman William McKinley of Ohio proposed a new tariff bill, one that would raise import taxes higher than ever before. The tax already was about 38% on most imported products. The new measure would raise it to almost 50%.
Not everyone in the Harrison administration supported the high tariff measure. Secretary of State Blaine wanted to increase trade between the United States and other countries. He warned that new high tariffs would destroy those plans. Blaine also opposed the bill because he felt it would hurt the Republican Party politically. In a letter to Congressman McKinley, Blaine said the bill would anger the farmers by adding as much as 8% to the price of shoes for their children. Such movements as this for protection, said Blaine, will move the Republican Party only into speedy defeat.
Most Western and Southern congressmen opposed the tariff bill because it would mean higher prices to the people of their states. But the bill could not pass without the support of some of them. So supporters of the tariff bill offered a deal. If Westerners voted for the tariff measure, then Eastern lawmakers would support a silver purchase bill that the Westerners wanted. The bill, known as the Sherman Silver Purchase Act, would have the government buy 4.5 million ounces of silver each month. The government would pay for the silver with paper money, treasury notes, which could be exchanged for gold or silver money.
Western mines were producing huge amounts of silver. By selling it to the government, the mining interests hoped to keep the price of silver from falling. Western interests spoke in Congress now with a much stronger voice. In 1889 and 1890, six Western territories became states. This added 12 more Western representatives in the Senate and others in the House. The deal was agreed to. Both the McKinley Tariff Bill and the Sherman Silver Purchase Bill were approved by Congress and signed by President Harrison. As expected, the price of imported goods rose, and the people blamed the Republicans.
In the congressional elections of 1890, the Republican Party suffered heavy losses. The Republican majority in the Senate was cut to 8, and not all the Republican senators would support the party on every issue. The Republicans lost control in the House of Representatives. Only 88 were elected to House seats. Democrats elected 235 representatives. Voters also elected 9 House members and 2 senators from a new political organization, the People's Party. The new party was born in farming areas of the West and South. It was a party of protest, formed by men who refused to support either of the two old parties.
Years before, farmers had united in agricultural organizations they called granges. A national grange had been formed. During hard times, the grange organized political action groups to help elect officials who were friendly to farmers. But as farm conditions improved, the granges began to disappear. A few years later, farmers began to build new organizations. Like the granges, they began as social and economic groups. By the late 1880s, many of these groups had united into 2 large organizations. One, with more than 1 million members, was the Southern Alliance. The other, with fewer members, was the National Farmers Alliance. Members of the 2 groups began to unite for political action.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.